Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:18 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is September 17th and it's Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off with Treasuries because there's a very mild upward bias that's been held now for the last 3 months, but really yields haven't gone very far. So I think there is sort of an air in the market saying there's nothing to see here. And when we look at just what the nominal value is, 1.36%, well, it doesn't exactly point towards a lot of fear about inflation. Of course, yields are substantially above where they were back in the depths of the pandemic in 2020, and this continues to look like a higher reaction low, and there's the prospect for additional upside. So in many respects, this is less about inflation and more about the willingness of the US government to print and go off and borrow a ton of money. And they look ready to do that with the discussions about, there's inevitably going to be discussions about the debt ceiling over the course of the next 3 or 4 weeks. So that pantomime is going to play out, and eventually there will be some deal brokered that will deliver a higher debt ceiling, and then they're going to move on to trying to push through the $3.5 trillion spending plan. Now maybe it only is eventually $2.5 trillion, but it's still an awful lot of money, and that's going to have to be funded with additional debt. And will there be a ready market for it? And will investors be willing to buy it at a yield of 1.36%? Maybe they'd rather to be compensated at a rate of 2% or maybe 2.5%. And of course, that's also particularly relevant when you have the Federal Reserve, who continue to talk about tapering. And central banks all over the world are talking about tapering. And one does really beg the question, just how are they going to taper? And will they be able to taper at the rate that they think is possible? Because governments have greatly increased the quantity of debt outstanding. And there were well-publicized events that occurred in 2020 that the total debt for governments surged higher in 2020, and yet the cost of servicing that debt declined because of this massive compression in yields. Well, the debt continues to rise, and yet yields are more than double what they were back in 2020, and there is the potential that they can go higher from here. So when we start to think about what's going on, well, I think that this is much more of a supply versus demand story than a specifically an inflation story, because the majority of investors are not convinced that inflation is a permanent phenomenon. They continue to buy into the Federal Reserve's prognostication that this is going to be transitory. And this is also applicable to the UK and to much of Europe as well. The ECB has also used transitory as their word of choice, and so have the UK. So what we're starting to see here is the potential that there's going to be a deluge of additional supply in the bond markets, and that should start to see the bond yield moving back up again. And I think that's particularly relevant, because when we look at the yield curve spread, well, the yield curve spread hasn't really gone much of anywhere for the last 3 months either. And it's been very easy to conclude that there's nothing to see here either. And we're right in the middle of the range that's been forming now for most of the last 30 years. So we're at this sort of do or die moment, because generally speaking, it's when the yield curve starts to trend higher that we start to see significant pressure coming to bear on markets. It's not generally until the yield curve spread is up around the 250 to 300 basis point level that central banks pull out all the stops and start printing again. So we certainly have this sequence of higher reaction lows, and that has been evident since July. It hasn't gone up very much in all that time, so it's been easy to ignore it. But it's worth considering that when we had a bit of a dip in the mega cap shares, so let's just go back and think about what did the Nasdaq do between about September and March and of last year and early this year? And we had a distinct bout of volatility in September, and prices didn't really break out again until December. And then we had a pretty substantial pullback again in February and March. Well, it's been a while since we've had a good pullback, but we are starting to extend declines in here today. So we had options expiring today, and prices are down a bit. If we see downside follow through next week, well, then that would suggest that potentially we're moving back into a similar type of corrective phase to what we saw in February and March. If we continue to see bond yields rising, it puts the greatest pressure on the companies that have done best from the availability of virtually limitless free credit. And that's particularly true for the semiconductor sector, for the new tech sector, and all those IPOs and SPACs that have IPO'd, and then of course the very large cap companies as well. When we think about the FAANG man designation, so that's the largest companies on the Nasdaq. And they represent a phenomenally large proportion of the market cap for the total market, and their total market cap as a perc of in total is up to 10 trillion, and it's still trending higher. So there's definitely been an acceleration in the size of that market cap for those seven companies over the course of the last year. There's absolutely no doubting that a lot of it has to do with one, the pandemic, because it created a one-time massive surge in demand for the types of products that they provide. So you've got Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Nvidia that all benefited from the pandemic. Then that was supplemented by money printing on an unprecedented level, and we're still in that environment because I cannot see how the deficit spending that's being proposed by governments to build back better, to provide better social conditions for more people, well, all of that doesn't come free. The UK has been rather forthright in saying that paying for it is going to have to require additional taxes. But there's likely to be a significant shortfall in any additional tax rate raising revenue measures that the US announces relative to what the spending plans are. So it's increasingly likely that we're going to continue to see additional money printing and the facilitation of massive deficit spending by the US, I think facilitated by the Federal Reserve. As long as that remains the case, then the bull market will persist. We definitely saw the Federal Reserve was willing to raise interest rates and engage in fiscal, or excuse me, I engage in quantitative taper, not tapering, but they were willing to quantitative tightening, I should say, that back in 2018 and 19, and that was setting the stages for a recession. They started to ease up on that when they got frightened about the high yield market and then the repo markets. But what we now are betting, what investors are betting on, is that they're not going to do that any longer, that they're not going to try and withdraw the punch bowl when spending increases in a big way, but rather they're going to facilitate it. And that's a very different environment. So when we think about changes, when we think about the kinds of things that the kinds of events where central banks make mistakes, well, that's a massive change in their policy, and it holds out the prospect that what we're seeing is a significant policy mistake from central banks, because historically they have been worried about inflation, and now they're worried about deflation. So they are going to do whatever it takes to create an inflationary trend over the medium term. And the problem with monitoring it today is twofold. The first is that we have a lot of commodity price volatility. So that's certainly feeding through into expectations for inflationary pressures. One of the most important sources of the perception of inflation is oil. And Brent crude prices are now up around $75. And we had a big upside Q reversal about 4 weeks ago. And since then, we've had upside follow through. It looks increasingly likely that we will see the price get up towards 80. And if we continue to see demand growth and an absence of additional supply coming into the market, well, then prices can continue to rise from there. Of course, there is still plenty of supply sitting outside the market, but then there's also been a slow recovery in the demand side of the equation. So we're still in a lopsided environment for the global energy sector. I think it's quite likely that we saw a peak coming through in natural gas prices this week. Natural gas in the US was down in a dynamic manner over the last 2 days. And when we look at this over the lengthy medium term, well, we're still in this very long base formation. Prices haven't been able to sustain a move above $6 since 2009. So 12 years of going sideways is a significant length of time. And now we're starting to see demand growth drivers starting to reappear. So I think it's quite likely that on this occasion, we're unlikely to go all the way back down to the lows around the $2 level, but instead, we'll likely see prices stabilize at a higher level overall. And if that's true of the USA, it's doubly true of the UK. We've had a profound acceleration in UK gas prices, and they're now starting to come back down. And the number of factors that have coincided, or I guess conspired, to create this acceleration is quite profound. So we've had shutdowns in supply from the North Sea and Norway, then the hurricanes in the USA have deterred additional supply coming from there. Then we've had the wind has stopped blowing. So all of these factors together have created this exceptional advance. There are a number of European policymakers are accusing Gazprom of artificially depressing the supply of gas into Europe. So they're going more for the conspiracy theory way of explaining it. The reality is, however, that Europe is beholden to Russia for the supply of gas. And as we move increasingly towards a and politicians adopt these net zero targets where they want to try and stop using coal entirely, well, it has to be replaced with something. And we already have so much wind and solar in the energy mix that intermittency is becoming a problem. So something has to provide base load. And at the moment, the easiest thing to do is to build natural gas power plants. And then on top of that, All of the automotive companies are planning on releasing additional new electric vehicle models. And that's likely to start to ramp up from this year and into 2023 in particular, when the vast majority of automakers will be releasing majority numbers of electric vehicles. One thing that we saw today with Lucid Group is that their big claims about the range of their electric vehicle have been approved by the EPA. So they're the first company to successfully get an EPA rating of over 500 miles for their electric vehicle. But I thought the more important point was the speed of charging, because they are drawing hundreds of kilowatts, and they are anticipating that they can get 20 miles of range in a minute and as much as 300 miles of range in 20 minutes. So that's incredibly quick, and it means that they are drawing at an exceptional rate in terms of their electricity demand. And that's just for the one vehicle. But when this type of technology becomes more widely available, and Lucid Group will start selling more affordable cars in due course, then it's going to represent a very significant source of additional new demand. So on the one hand, it's going to be an increase in absolute demand, but on the other, it's going to increase the urgency of demand at particular times. And then there's no guarantee that the demand growth surges are going to coincide with the sunniest times of the day or the windiest times of the day. So there's going to have to be additional surge demand and provision. So that is a demand growth driver story for natural gas. It's also a really just a medium-term solution, because it's not going to solve the or to deliver on the utopian ideals of the green movement. So eventually there's going to have to be different solutions, and nuclear is certainly looking up right now. So the uranium ETFs continue to push on the upside. The fact that Sprott Asset Management have bought up the excess supply in the market has been a significant advance in seen a significant advance in prices. Now, we've had a downward dynamic in here today, but the reality is that we have a short-term overbought condition, and now we're going to get some consolidation. But the chances are that this is a new uptrend, and we've had an exceptionally lengthy bear market in uranium equities. So I think it's quite likely that this is going to be a buy the dip scenario for the foreseeable future. Now, obviously, there is a significant media problem with uranium and the safety record of the nuclear sector overall, and some countries are more accepting of the need for additional nuclear energy than others. But ultimately, if we're going for more of an electric future, regardless of how that electricity is used, it has to come from somewhere. And if countries are unwilling to burn the coal, well, then that's likely to represent a bull market environment for natural gas overall. Of course, the large companies like Royal Dutch Shell or Exxon, who produce more gas than oil anyway, they are still struggling to attract investors, as a lot of companies are no longer going to be invested in by big pension funds. They don't want to have the moniker of supporting companies that are destroying our environment. So Royal Dutch Shell continues to range below the 1500p level. If it can sustain a move above that level, well, then we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. So it is possible that We could see additional upside in due course, but if natural gas prices have indeed peaked in the short term, well, then it might delay that kind of response as well. Now, we can also think about the downtrend that's evolving in Rio Tinto. It has broken downwards again in here this week. So it's now trading below the 5,000 level, and that was a floor. Well, it was an area of resistance in 2019 and 20, and a floor earlier this year. So it's now trading below that level. This is looking increasingly like a type 2 top formation, and we have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And it's going to have to rebound in a more forthright manner in order to confirm a return to demand dominance. It would be easy to think that the very sharp decline in iron ore prices, where we've had a halving in little more than 2 months, that would be in normal circumstances. I think investors would be concluding that that was indicative of really quite significant trouble in the Chinese economy. But it may simply be that we are only 4.5 months away from the 2022 Winter Olympics, and China wants to have clean air for all the cameras that are going to appear in and around Beijing in 4 months' time. So they're trying to cut down on steel production, they're trying to cut down on coal production. But it's an unanswered question how on earth they're going to be able to shut down all those coal-fired power stations in the depths of winter. Because China gets cold. And when, and historically, they have set dates when the heating comes on, our air conditioning can be used. And once the heating gets turned on, well, then people tend to leave it on for the whole winter. So, what's going to replace all of that demand for coal? Well, the only viable opportunity is likely to be natural gas. So, we're quite likely to see additional upward pressure on downward pressure on steel prices, even though we have a short-term oversold condition, and there's certainly scope for a bounce in the short term, but it's unlikely to trend higher. And aluminium prices got all the way up to test their all-time peaks. So now we're probably going to get some consolidation here as well. But the reality is that natural gas prices are probably peaking, but we'll find a higher support level. Aluminium prices have probably gone as far as they're going to in the short term and are probably going to have some consolidation, but will probably hold most of that move. Then, when we think about the copper price, I think copper is the middle road. I think copper is much more indicative of what's happening in the Chinese economy than either aluminium or steel, because the steel production is, in many respects, about politics. Copper is more about the property sector. So we've had meaningful drawdowns in property this year. And Evergrande is trending down, and it was at another new low in here this week. So it's below its IPO level, and it could go bankrupt this weekend. There's a holiday in China on Monday and Tuesday. So if they want to announce a bankruptcy, at least they would have a 2 day holiday to get their affairs in order. And of course, if they don't take this weekend as that opportunity, well, then the beginning of October is also going to represent Golden Week. So that's the official holiday for the Mid-Autumn Festival. So it's increasingly likely that we are going to see China Evergrande go bust, and that company has got significant liabilities. So one thing we are starting to see is there was a downside Q reversal, a weekly Q reversal on the Shanghai Property Index, but it was a little steadier in here today. And Then we can think about the Hang Seng Properties Index, and that was also pulling back sharply, but it was also in positive territory today. So it does look like there is at least some evidence that the monetary and fiscal authorities in China are not willing to allow I guess they're willing to do what's necessary to avoid contagion. China Evergrande is being made an example of. They're trying to snuff out moral hazard from the property sector. They did rescue China Huarong Asset Management in the summer. That was originally a bad bank, and then it was run as a very risky lending operation, but it was majority owned by the government, so they didn't have much choice. They had to bail it out. So Evergrande is not owned by the government. It's a private enterprise, but it is a massive property holder. They have $300 billion of US dollar denominated debt, so that's been sold to international investors. And really, nobody knows exactly who holds all of that. There are rumors flying around whether that is has to do with Tether, whether it has to do with and the commercial paper that they've been buying for the stable coin. How many of the big international funds that have been owning emerging market bond debt have been invested in China Evergrande? But then there are also the domestic liabilities that it has. Just the cost of doing business represents a significant draw on finances. They're trying to give cut price properties to people that are complaining and protesting about the loss of their deposits and the ceasing of operations in building the apartments that they've already paid for. So there's certainly a lot going on in China right now. We have the significant volatility in the commodity markets because of the preparations for the Olympics. We have these bankruptcies that are inevitable in the property sector. But then, of course, there is this challenge about, well, it's very easy to think about whether the Federal Reserve is making a policy mistake in just adapting their mantra to foment inflation rather than to combat it. Whereas in China right now, they've been tightening, and the credit impulse has been contracting, and it's been contracting for a good long time. So the question then is, are we going to see the credit impulse turning back upwards? Because if the credit impulse turns upwards again, well, then that would be a green light for speculation. If, on the other hand, they have decided that they are not going to step in with additional liquidity, or they're not going to reduce the reserve requirements for the banking sector, well, I think that would qualify as a policy mistake. And there is significant contagion risk from the unwinding of leverage in China Evergrande. And the number of off-balance sheet the liabilities that the company has is pretty much impossible to quantify for anyone who's not directly involved with the company. So the number that's been floated around is 300 billion. It could easily be double that, if not more. And obviously, this is a significant challenge. Now, the size of the onshore bond market is around 12 trillion. So when we start thinking about how large is the liability that China Evergrande has, it's a significant proportion. If the company goes bust, it's going to represent a default rate of somewhere in the region of about 14% relative to what it is right now of about 3%. The point that I've been making for years now is that the one thing we don't know, and we have no way of knowing with regard to China, is what is the natural default rate. In the USA, or in well-established corporate bond markets, where we've been through a number of boom and bust cycles, then it's reasonably easy to conclude that generally the default rate is somewhere between about 5 and 10%. And that's in extremis. So that's one of the primary figures used by disaster investors. People like Oaktree and Howard Marks, who have made careers of stepping in and buying bonds at deep discounts, they've been able to do that because they have a reasonable degree of certainty about what is the natural default rate. So, in the teeth of a crisis, they can look at what the default rate is and determine is it likely to get worse or are we close to a low? And certainly, the kinds of yields that are available on debt in China today are extraordinary. So, there's certainly going to be a lot of interest from the likes of disaster investors in debt because they can pick up these extraordinarily attractive yields. But the uncertainty principle is that they don't know what that natural default rate is. So, it's going to be difficult. And one has to come up with a political agenda. It's not enough to simply look at the way that the market is performing, or the currency is performing, or how the intricacies of each individual issuer are doing. One has to come up with a political view, because it's a big question whether there will be big measures introduced to rescue the private companies. We can pretty much be guaranteed that the semi-state or the partially state-owned companies will be rescued, but that the private companies will not be. So we're certainly in a difficult environment for the Chinese property sector and the financial sector. And I think it's increasingly likely that China will attempt to avoid a systemic issue, and they'll try to limit exposure to contagion. But the only way that they're going to be able to do that is if they print more money and provide more liquidity. So it's increasingly likely that we are going to see a trough in the credit cycle. And that would suggest that there will be opportunities. So certainly we've seen that a lot of institutional investors are betting on companies like Alibaba. And the share is beginning to bounce from the lower side of the range. We can then think about Pinduoduo, where the CEO of the company has lost more money than anyone else in China this year, even more than Jack Ma. And the share declined more than 50%, and it is potentially putting in a higher reaction low right now. JD.com, which is the other big e-commerce company in China, has at least found support in the region of the trend mean. So this is quite different from the kind of activity we're seeing in the property sector, where a large number of companies have broken downwards. The tech sector looks increasingly likely that the worst of the selling pressure is over, and we're going to have to see significant new surprises, negative surprises for the tech sector to derail the potential that the lows are in fact in. In many respects, investors are making the same bet on tech in China today that were made on tech back in 2009 and 10, because back then it was the property sector was also the problem, and it was the technology sector that benefited from the allocation of additional new money. So that's exactly the same rationale being used for investing in these tech companies today. So we're certainly in a rather interesting environment with regard to China. And China Evergrande's bankruptcy is likely to be a catalyst for additional new liquidity provisions. Then we can think about gold, because the gold price pulled back very sharply last week, or I should say this week. And so far it has not bounced. So the question, therefore, has to be, is the $1,700 level going to hold? We can just zoom in and look at this on a daily chart, and we can think about where are the downward or the dynamics. And there's no questioning that the big downward dynamics have all been on the downside, and that's not bullish. So the big question then is the significant rebound off the low in around 1700. That was certainly the I think the most bullish phenomenon we've seen in gold for most of the last year. Now the question is whether that low around 1700 is going to hold. I do think that a lot of when people got worried about China Evergrande, they sold gold because they were concluding that in a worst case scenario where there is a recession in China and the issue is not contained, and the worst case scenario unwinds, where there is a crash in the property market, well then people would have to sell gold to cover their other liabilities. So that's what the bearish argument is for gold, that a problem in China would cause selling pressure. Whereas if we're not going to have a problem in gold, or not going to have a problem in the property market, well, there'll be less selling in gold, there'll be more money printed. So then we would have the USA printing more money, China printing more money, and that would act as a tailwind for gold. So if China does start to turn the corner in terms of the credit impulse, and we do start to see additional money being printed around the world and efforts to create an inflationary bias overall, well then that is likely to act as a tailwind for gold. And all we need to see is a sustained move above about $1,825 to confirm a return to demand dominance. But in the meantime, it's for the bulls to prove, and we're still in this volatile environment overall. One thing I thought was interesting over the course of the last 5 months is that in the middle of the month, we've had a pop in the upside in the VIX index, and subsequently, prices have pulled back. And then the VIX comes back down, and we get a rebound to new highs within the next 10 days. So the VIX index was up again in here today. We're still in an environment on Wall Street which is easing. And a large part of that has to do with the considerable upward pressure that we're seeing on government bond yields. Then, what about the US dollar? Because the dollar tends to do well when there's demand for a safe haven. So we're certainly seeing that the dollar index is firming from the region of the trend mean. And this looks like an orderly consolidation following a deep decline in 2020. Until we see a sustained move below the trend mean, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. I've been on the wrong side of this trade for most of the last year. I did think that the dollar was on the cusp of breaking lower, but it does not look like that is likely in the near term. As long as the dollar is reasonably firm, well, it suggests that there are bigger problems outside the US than there are inside, and it really is a race to the bottom in terms of purchasing power for various currencies. Europe is dealing with the reality of having to rely on the Russians for natural gas, and Germany in particular has been closing their nuclear power plants. The euro was down in a dynamic manner over the course of the last few days, so there's certainly potential here that we could see additional downside. Generally speaking, a weaker currency has been a tailwind in terms of nominal pricing for the stock market, but it was also in negative territory today. I think it's increasingly likely that we are moving into more of a corrective phase overall. We've had a powerful move on the upside over the course of the last year, valuations have increased, yields are starting to rise. It's a natural time for stock markets to begin to take a breather. I think then it's also, I think, relevant that the Australian market, which has really been incredibly consistent on the upside, is back testing the upper side of the underlying trading range. And I think if Australia breaks on the downside, well then that will be also indicative of more worry about the pace of tapering by the RBA, but also worried about the pace of exports to China. And a lot of people tend to think about the coal and the iron ore that's exported to China, but increasingly it'll be about natural gas. If Australia breaks down, well then we're very likely that the global economy is moving more into a corrective phase, and not least because of worries about what's going on in China. And the Australian dollar encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean last week, followed through on the downside this week. So this is still a downward trend overall. And that also, I think, is likely to lead to a much lengthier timeline for tapering by the Australian Central Bank. And we're in an environment where commodities are taking a hit, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going on in China because of the property market and also because of the Olympics. There is certainly downward pressure coming through in the industrial resources and also weighing on the broad precious metals sector. Whereas we continue to see upward pressure in energy, and we continue to see upward pressure in food prices. And food is breaking on the upside. But then also we're seeing that rapeseed oil and canola oil, which are basically the same thing, are trending higher as well. So the energy portion of the agricultural sector continues to do well, and not least because of continued demand for natural gas and alternatives in terms of fuel and electricity provision. And that's an additional reason why the sugar price has been pushing on the upside over the course of the last few months as well. Inevitably, if wheat and rough rice break on the upside, that's going to contribute to additional social unrest. And I think the role of social unrest in shaping government policies and the fear of it is underappreciated, because it's extremely difficult to introduce fiscal tightening if one is worried about mobs in the street. And with higher food prices and higher energy prices, then that is eating into the purchasing power of regular people. More importantly, it's contributing to the perception of inflation. When the price of used cars moderates, well, that doesn't matter to most people until they actually need to go and buy a car. But when inflation in food and energy rises, well, then that hits everybody every day. And it's one of the leading causes of in the perception that inflation is rising. There was headlines at the beginning of this week that CPI came in below expectations, but it was still 5.8%. So we're seeing this environment where we get these year-over-year comparisons that are outsized either on the upside or the downside, but that the base levels continue to increase. And I suspect that this is what we're going to see with large numbers of commodities, that we get surges and declines, but ultimately prices continue to trend higher. And we are in a more fragile global economic environment. And that is both a function, and I think the primary symptom of fragility is interest rates. Because when interest rates are high, then investment decisions have to be measured against the discount rate. When there's no discount rate, then investment decisions on infrastructure are based upon the situation continuing indefinitely, and that there will always be access to new money to solve whatever problems are introduced as a result of mismanagement. So we've seen the electricity grids come under extraordinary pressure. We've seen an environment where because we have these low interest rates, there was the shock of the pandemic last year, and the commitment in earnings calls in September or Q3 of 2020, where everybody was talking about resilience. Whereas just this week, we had the CEO of Volkswagen basically talking about the fact that they don't need to have 120 days of supply. They can get by with 50, and they've seen their margins expand. So they are now running even more just-in-time practices. And they can do that because of the low interest rate environment. They can do that because of globalization and the optimization of supply chains. So we're running very tight ships right now. There are no margins for error being built into the global supply chain, whether that has to do with the provision of goods and services or the provision of electricity. When we look at wage growth, then there is this extremely tight labor market right now, which is pushing up wages and it's pushing up inflation. So that's also going to increase the vulnerability of the lower paid portions of society to inflationary pressures. Again, it's an enormously fragile environment. So one thing that we can certainly think about is that because we are in this extremely low interest rate environment, and where we've seen these extraordinary accelerations, and we see companies with market caps numbered in the trillions, well, that would not have been possible in a higher interest rate environment where liquidity is less abundant. So we've definitely had a bull market over the course of the last decade, which has been predicated on liquidity. And we're still in an enormously benign environment for liquidity overall. The total assets of central banks continues to trend higher, and deficit spending is somewhere in the order of 2 trillion. I had a question earlier this week asking for me to I think be clearer on what I meant by adoption of modern monetary theory. What I really think about in terms of modern monetary theory, it's not that countries haven't been willing to run deficits in the past, but rather those deficits today are being facilitated by central banks. And we're at a situation with debt that it has increased to such an extraordinary extent that there is a self-fulfilling prophecy element to it, that there's just no way to bring down the quantity of debt. And eventually, that is going to lead to an inflationary problem. So we're still in this environment where there are deflationary forces. And what's going on in China today is certainly potentially a deflationary set of forces. And that is likely to lead to a significant monetary response. So when we can identify what the problem is, it doesn't necessarily mean that the problem is going to crest imminently. But we do need to be aware of what the problems are, and we need to monitor the consistency characteristics of the trends. So I do think that the performance of the Fangman Index relative to the wider market is an important chart to monitor, because it has bounced emphatically over the course of the last few months, and then it's gone sideways. So, was the third quarter of 2020 the peak performance of the largest companies? And is their relative performance starting to ebb? That's an awfully big question. Microsoft this week announced that they're buying back $60 billion worth of their equity. And the share is pausing around the $300 level. It's still a consistent trend. And over the course of the last couple of years, pullbacks in the order of about $25 have been buying opportunities. We're likely to move into an environment where we could easily get a $25 pullback. But then will buyers start to come back in? Will liquidity start to increase? Central banks are talking about their willingness, and their desire to taper assistance. I've seen no talk about how able governments will be to absorb the rising cost of servicing their debt. And that's something that would create significant social unrest. So we're still in a benign environment. The only way that this bull market is going to end is when interest rates have to rise. And interest rates won't have to rise until inflation is ramping higher, and doing so in such a concerted fashion that central banks eventually have to act. And we're just not there yet. In fact, right now, most people are more worried about deflation than inflation. And what happens in China is going to have a material effect, because in the event that China is on the point of its debt issues cresting, that will have global ramifications. We don't see any evidence of contagion risk right now. And even the property sectors in Hong Kong and Shanghai are starting to steady. I continue to think that the most likely scenario is that the credit impulse in China is troughing, that we're on the cusp of seeing additional new liquidity flowing into the market, so that pullbacks will be limited to equal-sized reactions or reversions towards the mean, but that we do not have topping activity right now, and we're still in a benign monetary environment. And as long as that remains the case, then we can likely continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, with, of course, the proviso that big trends that are overextended relative to the trend mean are much better bought following reactions rather than buying new highs. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.